Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled Top 10 Government Errors and How to Correct Them. I'm J.J. Area, AILA's Education Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Dagmar Butte, a member of the AILA Board of Governors and the AILA USCIS Service Center Operations Liaison Committee Chair from Portland, Oregon. Joining Dagmar is Linda Kinnipaski, an AILA Distance Learning Committee co-chair from New York, New York, and Steve Thal from Minnetonka, Minnesota. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Dagmar.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us today for this podcast. When we were preparing for this presentation, we realized that there are probably more than 10 government mistakes that you all are frustrated with on a day-to-day basis. But given that we only have about an hour to present the information, we are going to limit ourselves to the top 10 list. And the first place where we're going to start is in the catch-all category of USCIS goofed with respect to sending us a benefit or correspondence, goofed with respect to being able to find our clients' files, goofed with respect to information on an approval notice, an EAD, or other official document, and then, of course, the ever-popular, wow, why can't they get my client's priority date correct? So, Linda, when you start seeing this grab basket of problems, what do you typically do?
Well, the first thing I do is I start with the USCIS online case system, case status system, and you know that can kind of help you determine where your case can be. Sometimes it's not accurate, but it's a good place to start. And then I would call the National Customer Service Center and speak to the officer that gets on the telephone about what the problem is. They will put you through a set of questions that they always ask, and you know, you'll frame your issue, and they should give you a referral number, the agent name, and the time of the call. And they generally do that. So you'll give your inquiry to them, and then wait a little time, wait 15 days or so. And if you don't get a response in that time, then you could follow up with the service center, California Service, Nebraska, Texas, or Vermont, and they have email addresses that you can send your inquiry to. And then if that doesn't get you anywhere, you wait about 30 days for that. And usually then you would go on to the SCOPES, SCATA, the SCOPES-SCATA email address, and you would present your problem to them. And if you don't get something in 21 days, then you could contact AILA Liaison. And I think, Dagmar, you're going to talk a little bit more about AILA Liaison. So that's generally what we do when we have a problem. Sometimes it's possible to solve it, in the first step when you call National Customer Service Center. Usually not. And sometimes, depending on what they tell you to do, if, for example, it's an EAD that has the incorrect photo on it. It's happened a lot with our clients recently. We've seen a lot of issues with EADs for some reason. Wrong A numbers, wrong dates of birth, wrong gender, just about anything you could think of. So often what they'll do when we call in the NCSC customer service number is they'll tell us to just refile with no fee.
With no fee, right? That makes sense. And Steve, what about if all of these processes don't work? Do you ever use the Ombudsman's Office or congressional assistance? How do you feel about those two options?
Absolutely. Yeah, great point, Dagmar. Actually, I've used the Ombudsman's Office quite a bit, but it's important to know initially that you do have to follow the steps, as Linda outlined, prior to using the Ombudsman. The Ombudsman, of course, is independent, reports directly to the Secretary of Homeland Security. They do a lot of monitoring of the types of issues that cause frustrations with practitioners as well as clients in terms of dealing with USCIS. So they're pretty receptive to being able to handle the types of requests that we need to follow up on. So on many of these examples, by submitting an online inquiry to the CIS Ombudsman, they do have a case assistance form that you can fill out online, as well as upload a G28 as attorney or representative, and any relevant documents that would assist them in trying to resolve the particular issue. Unfortunately, they do have, of course, a limited staff, but the number of case problems seems to be rising exponentially, and they're probably handling in excess of 10,000 such requests per year. But
wow.
I found them to be generally very effective. You will get an email response from them from the submission of your request so that you'll have a case number to follow up on. And again, depending on the urgency of the request or any expedite that might be required on it, typically you will, I think, generally receive a response within 30 days, sometimes less, again, depending on the circumstances. I was going to add, too, that AILA has a liaison committee with the CIS Ombudsman. I had served on that committee for 2 years, and when I was on it, I actually wrote an article on using the Office of the CIS Ombudsman, an assistance remedy of last resort, which is contained in the AILA publication Inside Immigration, the September 2014 issue, which you can get on AILA Agora. So anyway, it is an effective case process to pursue. I've also used congressional liaisons, too. I try not to use both simultaneously. I think sometimes that might work to your disadvantage, but in appropriate cases where I've built relationships with certain staffers at some of the offices, I'll reach out to them, and sometimes they're able to get through. I find them, congressional liaisons, especially more effective on overseas or consular issues.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And again, that's not something where the CIS Ombudsman would get involved because it's not Department of Homeland Security.
That makes sense. Oh, sorry, Linda, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to add something about the congressional liaison. I agree, Steve, that that's something you kind of want to do at the very end, because I've seen situations where people got impatient when we were going through the regular process and they went to a congressional liaison, which caused the file to be taken from where it was about to be worked on and taken over to a congressional unit and actually slowed things down. So, that wasn't the intent of the congressional liaison person, but that's what happened. So I think, that kind of leads towards the end and maybe for cases that are out of the country at the U.S. consulate.
And in fact, if you are going to use the AILA USCIS liaison process, you cannot simultaneously use the congressional process. And so I want to alert folks to AILA document number 1606-1604. Again, that's 1606-1604. It's dated June 16, 2016. And you can find it on InfoNet, and it outlines the AILA liaison process. It includes the three steps Linda mentioned, and then what ultimately happens is that if you get no response from the scopscada@dhs.gov email, that case gets escalated to me or whoever is lucky enough to sit in the SCOP Service Center chair position. And I have a counterpart at USCIS with whom I work to resolve these cases. But the critical thing to remember is that that process really generally only works for what truly are errors or delays by the government. If you disagree with a particular result in a case, that isn't necessarily an error. So we have much, much better success rates fixing things like typos on documents, notices that were never delivered, that sort of thing, as opposed to, well, I believe the government applied the wrong standard to my EB1 filing and my client had sufficient evidence, etc. So be careful when you try to figure out how to solve your problem to see whether it really is more of a policy discretion decisional issue with which we have a lot less success than something where it is simply an error, a delay, or a change in the way that the government had been doing things all of a sudden. For those cases, we have pretty good success rates with the USCIS Service Center Operations folks. They really actually do want to help. It's just kind of like the Ombudsman's Office. They're also overwhelmed.
And sometimes, too, it's you can go a little bit outside this protocol that we outlined. For example, when the government can't locate a file, you go in mm-hmm. for, let's say, a USCIS 245 interview, they can't locate the file, they can't locate it. You can pursue a local way of getting that file located. A lot of the jurisdictions, the 245 unit, will allow emails to be sent out, or email lists to be sent out, so that we can contact supervisors by email and, you know, present a problem. We did that recently on a case. Just went directly to the supervisor of the 245 unit, who was able to track down the file and get an adjudication. So that's a little bit outside the steps that we outlined before.
Linda, this is Steve. We've had a similar issue arise here in Minnesota too, where sometimes it's more effective to go in on an info pass.
Mm-hmm.
You're
mm-hmm.
then at least dealing directly live with an individual on the other side of the counter, and we've had situations where they've been able to locate files and actually even retrieve them. In fact, we came across kind of a operational issue that had come up, especially where there were cases in removal proceedings that were being terminated to allow for filing of adjustment of status directly with USCIS, and although those files were to have been transferred over to the local USCIS office by the Office of Chief Counsel, we discovered they were being sent back to the Record Center for storage. And so by intervening through our local liaison with the field office director, we're able to put in a fix on that problem. So at least now we can have them directly transferred.
There's no substitute sometimes for dealing with a real human, and I wish that were more of an option in the service center-based practice. One thing I want to add before we move to our next topic is I do want to add that service center liaison process that I outlined, if it is an emergency scenario, things like a denial of a request to expedite a case or a case where a time-sensitive notice has not been received, those kinds of cases, you can skip those steps, and ALA liaison will bring those cases straight to the SCOPS chair, and we take them straight to service center operations. On easily resolved issues, we often get responses within a few days, sometimes even the next day if it's an emergency. Unfortunately, if it's cases in administrative processing, the response we typically get is the case is in administrative processing, and we'll monitor it and let you know if it moves. So it really runs the gamut in terms of responses.
Dagmar, before we move on to the next topic, too, I did want to mention as kind of a great summary of the various types of issues that we've been dealing with. The ALA Liaison Department also put out in June 2016 a document available on ALA Infonet called Case Resolution Strategies, How Do I Resolve Problem Cases? And it'll deal with many of the issues that we've mentioned here. And that can be found at ALA document number 10100873. Again, 10100873. And that was posted June 1, 2016.
Wonderful.
Dagmar, could I add one more thing?
Sure.
This is about the special procedures for VAWA, U, or T cases. You can actually go right to the VAWA unit and contact them if there are, you know, it's a specific issue, and they're generally very responsive. You can look at ALA Infonet doc number 08092973, or if you're a Googler like I am, you can just go online and Google customer service avenues for VAWA, T, and U related filings, and you'll find emails, telephone numbers, and instructions on how to follow up on, you know, errors that are coming out of the VAWA unit.
Marvelous. And now I know a new word, Googler. All right. So let's proceed now to everyone's favorite agency, our friends at CBP, and the issues that we often face with respect to errors on I-94s or errors in a person's travel history. Steve, we'll tee it up to you first. How do you deal with those issues, and what do you recommend folks try to do to solve those problems?
Okay. Sure. Thanks, Dagmar. Well, first of all, we're very fortunate, at least here in our district in Minnesota, in having a direct email contact with our local CBP office. So typically the most common scenario that we run into is someone tries to retrieve their electronic I-94 on the CBP website. They put in all the proper information, but nothing comes up. And so when I have a client with that type of situation, I'll have them sign a G28. I'll take copies of their passport. If they have their airline ticket or any other of the travel information that's relevant, I'll make copies of that. We're able to scan that to a local CBP officer who has an office at our airport. And typically they're very responsive. They'll get back to us if it's something such as trying to retrieve the I-94. There have been instances where it isn't available to us as the public, but yet they do have the electronic copy, and they'll either fix something in the system, which will then allow us to retrieve it, or they can provide us proof or documentation that it indeed exists. The other type of issue that you raise also is correcting a travel history. One of the things that I picked up recently from another case too, and this I think primarily concerns visa waiver entrants, which, as you all know, are required to have a round-trip ticket when entering the U.S. However, there have been cases where maybe, you know, they've come in for 30 days but then changed their travel ticket, and they have up to 90 days, of course, as visa waiver entrants. But yet the system shows that they departed on the earlier date prior to changing the ticket. I'm not sure that there's necessarily a fix for that, but we usually, if it's going to be an issue, try to alert CBP that, no, this person has not left, they've made a change in the reservations, or if later it's, you know, an adjustment filing or some other immediate relative adjustment filing, that is, where it might be permitted, we just always make sure that our clients save all documentation on their travel itineraries, so that we're able to establish that, no, they did not, in fact, depart on a date that shows up in the system. To add to our arsenal, I guess, of practice pointers or other information that we can turn to on AILA InfoNet, there is a practice pointer that was put out by the AILA CBP Liaison Committee regarding the I-94 admission issues, best practices, and problem resolutions. And that was posted back in May 16 of 2013. It's AILA InfoNet document number 13051658. Again, 13051658. And that has a number of the points that we've discussed. One of the things, too, to be sure when you're trying to retrieve the automatic 94 is you have to use the name on the passport, not necessarily the name on the visa. And, in fact, there are instances where those names might differ. So, again, you have to make sure that you're using the name on the passport. And then one other useful link is in the AILA resources on the I-94 issue. And again, this was posted July 31, 2013. It's actually a whole page with various practice pointers as well as liaison minutes, practice alerts, and ways to resolve the issues surrounding I-94s. And that would be AILA document number 13050248. Again, AILA document number 13050248, posted July 31, 2013.
Great. Linda, do you have anything left to add on the I-94s, or do we want to go to mailroom problems?
Well, I have a little bit something, and I practice in New York and Newark, and in New York, that we've been told that we should go within 30 days of the person's arrival to the CBP office in New York. It's at JFK, and you know that they'll deal with making the correction, you know, if it's a date or something that's incorrect. And we also have email addresses, and I don't know if this is across the country, but they have kind of a cute email address. For New York, for example, it's i94jfk@cbp.dhs.gov. Newark is i94newark@cbp, et cetera. So I haven't actually used the email version of you know, dealing with this problem, but apparently it's out there and available, and it might be in other larger areas as well, so that you don't even have to go to the airport or to CBP.
Great, that's wonderful to hear. So now let's talk about the USCIS mailroom. A lot of our listeners may not know this, but the mailroom is actually a contractor. They are not employees of the United States Citizenship and Immigration Service. They are simply there to go through a checklist when a particular item arrives and make a determination of whether that item can be accepted and, if necessary, feed in, or whether it should be rejected for some reason, in which case it comes back to you. Unfortunately, probably all of us have had things come back to us, sometimes because we goofed, other times because they goofed. What do we do if they goofed, Linda?
Yeah, we see a lot of mailroom errors. And what's interesting, we send in these very nice, neat packages of information with the cover letter, and you get the application back, and it's a mess. And the cover letter is usually at the very back, which to me means that that's the least important thing, maybe, of what they're looking at in the eyes of the mailroom. Well, generally what I do, if it's something that's not time-sensitive, if it's just something that can be resolved very easily, I just repackage it and send it back again. I mean, that's very obvious, but that's what we do. But, you know, if it's something that seems to be more serious or some misunderstanding or something of that nature, it is possible to send an inquiry to the USCIS lockbox. It's lockboxsupport@dhs.gov. And you provide the case number, if there is a case number on the rejection notice, and a brief explanation of what the problem is. There's an ALA InfoNet doc that explains this in more detail. It's at 100-90263. And they're on kind of a short leash. If we don't get a response in 5 days, then we can turn to our ALA case liaison find out what the problem is. That can be also used for a receipting delay. You can contact the lockbox support and give proof of your having sent in the application by DHS or FedEx. And again, if you don't get a response after 5 days or get a response that's not adequate, you can go to ALA case liaison.
And the lockbox liaison also is fairly robust. We do have a group of volunteers that staff that in addition to ALA staff, so don't hesitate to use it if there is a scenario that is like what Linda is describing. Steve, any other suggestions? I know on our prep call you made a suggestion that I always forget is out there, so could you kind of repeat that one for our listeners?
Sure.
If it's a repeated reject?
Right. So sometimes what we've done is put both on the delivery envelope as well as on the interior package, do not open in mailroom for supervisory review or even add to it improper rejection. And then, of course, include kind of the history of, you know, what's been submitted and why the filing should be accepted. Generally, that's going to make it through the system, or at least we've had some success with that. A couple other things I would add to the discussion. Always make sure, of course, that you're using the most current form or any form that has the yes notation, where even if there's a more current form, that it would still be accepted. And the other practice tip that I would throw out, and believe it or not, I've had this happen in the past, even though I submitted the correct filing fee, I've learned that sometimes things can get rejected because the contractors can't necessarily add to know that what we've submitted is the correct filing fee. So, for instance, on a one-step application, $420 for the I-130 petition, $1,070 for the adjustment application, that's $1,490. And I've had it rejected where it's properly submitted as the $1,490. So we always send separate checks for each specific form or each specific component, whether it be biometrics or the application fee itself. And in that way, we've been able to avoid having that problem arise again in the future.
And in fact, sorry, Linda, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say this is a little bit off the topic, but we always use blue G28, so they pop, even though, you know, we don't really have to use any particular color anymore. But I think that helps at least get information to us more easily.
I think that's absolutely good advice. One thing to piggyback on Steve's comment regarding the separate checks, in the H-1 context, there are actually some checks that have to be separate, and that is a legitimate reason for rejecting the submission. So look at the instructions when you're submitting filing fees to make sure that you are, in fact, following the appropriate instructions with respect to how you make out your checks, what denominations those checks are in, et cetera. That will save you a lot of trouble at the front end, because if you are dealing with a contractor, they're not paid to adjudicate and think about these things. They're paid to process the incredible quantities of mail that are coming through as quickly and as efficiently as possible. So I think if we can leave you with one tip, it's simply to make everything as clear and easy for that mailroom person to accept as you possibly can, whether that means labeling things specially, whether that means using brightly colored paper or blue G28s, whatever it is, the more we can help them, the more we can reduce the number of erroneous rejections, or at least that's the hope. So the next topic on our list is actually dealing with our friends at the Department of Labor. And Linda and Steve, since you guys don't do a lot of this, I'm going to go through the basics on this for our listeners. And the biggest issue that we often see is in the context of permanent filings, permanent labor certification filings. One thing we're seeing is long, long delays getting the prevailing wage determination. 110 days is not unheard of these days, and when the prevailing wage comes back, what often happens is that our employers have a small stroke when they realize that because they're trying to get someone into the second employment preference, they required a bachelor's degree and 5 years of experience, and lo and behold, the wage came back at level four. So one of the things we're often asked is, what do we do if we disagree with the certifying officer's prevailing wage determination? Well, what you do is you actually request review by the Board of Alien Labor Certification of the wage determination. You have to do it within 30 days. You have to do it within writing, and you have to address it to the certifying officer who made the determination. Now, all this information can be found in the Frequently Asked Questions section of the DOL-ETA website. So most of that information will be there, but I'm going to try and summarize some of it for you at this point in time. The question arises also, what happens if a labor certification is denied, and it isn't denied because anything other than a departmental error. So depending on what the error is, you can actually request reconsideration. Again, you have to do it within 30 days of the determination. And if it's an agency error, you can specify that. And if BALCA determines that it is an agency error, then they will take that up and get that corrected. But you do have only 30 days to do it. You got to do it quickly. Also, if you filed an application that was denied based on incorrect or missing information on the ETA Form 9089, there are certain typographical errors that you can correct. Again, the instructions are on the Department of Labor's website for how to do that. So if it's clearly just a typographical error and you can document that it's a typo by showing the correct tear sheet, et cetera, then that will be one way to get that information corrected. The other area where we see a lot of issues from the Department of Labor is with respect to labor condition applications, or LCAs. Those are filed in the context generally of H-1 filings or in the context of E-3 filings. And what happens is often they get kicked back because the Federal Employer Identification Number, the FEIN, is deemed to be incorrect. That usually happens if the company has gone through a name change, gone through a merger, any sort of change in the company's identifying information that occurred since the FEIN was originally assigned by the Internal Revenue Service. There's a very straightforward process for dealing with that. It can all be done via email, and it's our experience that once you send the Department of Labor the information showing that you do in fact have the proper FEIN on your LCA, they adjudicate those very, very quickly after that. The other thing we have noticed is that sometimes they will actually spot our errors on the LCA. For example, I recall getting an email from the Department of Labor saying, did you really mean to pay this person $60,000 an hour? If you did, we're glad to do that. But if you didn't, would you like to correct it? So there is, believe it or not, apparently actually a human somewhere at the Department of Labor who does look at all of these LCAs as they come in. There must be some sort of flagging system. And if they see you having made an obvious error, they'll actually get in touch with you. So respond quickly, and that will get resolved pretty neatly. So that's the quick and dirty on the Department of Labor. Their FAQs are very, very detailed, both on correcting errors and filing appeals, asking for reconsideration. The timelines are very, very short. It's generally 30 days. So you have to really look carefully at anything you're getting from the Department of Labor to make sure it's correct in order to avoid having to redo things. So that's the quick and dirty on the Department of Labor. Steve and Linda, anything to add on that? I know you guys don't do a lot of work in that area, but anything to add on that?
No, I don't. Thanks.
Nope, nothing from my end either.
All right. So then we'll get to the fun part. Client keeps getting flagged for security issues when he or she returns from travel abroad, but they did nothing wrong. And let me tell you, I have this poor Sikh client whose last name is Singh, and whose first name is AJ. Do you know how many Sikhs are named AJ Singh? He keeps getting flagged. How do we help him?
Well, the secret to success in this area is boiled down to two words, DHS trip. That's about the only redress that we have. And in fact, that's even used in the acronym TRIP from Department of Homeland Security, which is Traveler Redress Inquiry Program, Traveler Redress Inquiry Program. So if you Google DHS TRIP, you'll get to the homepage where it'll set out the criteria for using the program as well as how to use the program, how to submit your inquiry, and what happens after that. So I've handled actually several of these. And in some of the cases, it wasn't known, or I mean, we didn't have any reason to know why this individual would be always subject to secondary inspection coming in. And I'll give a later example where we definitely knew there was a reason why it is that we elected to use DHS TRIP. So oftentimes, I think the explanation that's given is that there's a name or connection that's similar, perhaps with another traveler who might have something lurking in their background. And because of that, your client ends up being targeted or being subjected to secondary inspection or some other delay as a result of additional screening. So again, to begin with, it's nice if you can get a complete history of how these problems have occurred, where they've occurred, any underlying circumstances in the facts of the client's case. So one example I have is a Somali individual, again, who has a very common name, so it's quite possible, in fact, that it was as a result of picking up information on a person of same or similar name. And in fact, I recall from his removal case, which I handled, one of the issues that we felt had created a problem initially was there was another individual not only with the same name but with the same date of birth. Anyway, he had applied for naturalization, was put into removal proceedings. We successfully defended against the removal proceedings, which were terminated by the judge. He went back, continued with the naturalization process, got his U.S. passport, frequently traveled to Canada where he had family, but every time he came back in, he was always subject to secondary inspection. So anyway, we filled out the form, which is available online, and again, you can either download it and submit it with supporting documentation by mail, or more easily submitted electronically online with the DHS Form 591. You can also upload documents with it or to send by email in order to support your request. Basically, it asks for travel history, when the incidents occurred. You're asked to provide supporting documentation such as travel documents, birth certificates, naturalization certificates, anything that can help identify potential ways to take this person out of the system, if you will, by providing proper identity documents. After you submit your request, you will get an acknowledgement from the agency. They will say they will conduct a thorough review of the matter. Where appropriate, they will contact other agencies. And in the end, you'll eventually get a response or a letter where it'll give you the result, but it doesn't really give you the result. So the typical response that you'll get after you go through this process is DHS has researched and completed our review of your case. DHS TRIP can neither confirm nor deny any information about which we have that may be within federal watch lists or reveal any law enforcement sensitive information. However, we have made any corrections to records that our inquiries determined were necessary, including as appropriate notations that may assist in avoiding incidents of misidentification. So they'll never really confirm directly that whatever the issue is has been resolved, but hopefully with the information that's been in the system, it will allow the traveler to not have the recurring problem in the future. Now, one other thing that does come out of this that may be a key to preventing future problems is that you are given a redress control number, which will be sent in the letter as their final review, and you can actually use that redress control number when making future reservations. So actually, in preparation for this call, I went online at delta.com, and in fact, if you are filling out an application online to purchase a ticket, there will be a space where you can enter your redress number, and by doing so, hopefully that'll be the reference to the information with Transportation Security Administration or DHS that may be able to allow your trip to go forward without being subject to the ramifications of a deferred inspection or a further delays when coming back in. So anyway,
that's the
typical overview, but go ahead, Dagmar, and then if you want, I can give you a more down and dirty type case.
Yes, the one thing I wanted to say is that last suggestion is a really, really excellent one to think about, because unfortunately, sometimes even though the redress takes care of the matter for the time being, if the data dump that's causing the problem is coming from another agency, such as the criminal database, there's no way to really prevent that information from getting redumped if it hasn't been removed from that database. And so what sometimes happens is somebody gets their TRIP case resolved, but the data gets redumped back into the system. So if you have your redress number, that can help sort that issue out as well. So great tip, Steve.
Steve, I just wanted to ask you a question. Have you ever used this TRIP system for somebody with criminal issues?
Yeah, great question. So, let me actually read, if you will, for a little bit from one of the submissions that I handled on behalf of someone who did have a potential criminal issue. So this was a dual citizen, U.S. and Canada, and this was as a result of a single incident back in September 10 of 2000. So as part of our submission, I had this client write a statement which reads, on this particular date, following a lengthy business trip which manifested great fatigue on my part, I boarded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, the final leg of my return trip to Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. In what was a poorly executed attempt to make conversation, I made a remark to a flight attendant during the early stage of boarding that was understandably misinterpreted by him. Specifically, having consumed a considerable amount of chicken during my business trip, I carelessly and without forethought stated to the attendant that if I'm served another chicken sandwich, I'm going to kill someone. I realized at the very moment of this imprudence that my comment might not be given the context in which it was made. I immediately apologized to the attendant, having acknowledged my poor usage of words. Notwithstanding, the sole statement resulted in my arrest, wherein I spent one night in Hennepin County Jail in Minneapolis. No charges were ever brought, and I was never convicted of any offense. So anyway, that's kind of the story that led to this individual traveler always being pulled into secondary inspection. So again, we submitted through the process of DHS TRIP, made full confession, obviously, of this incident. And actually, he had caused himself another problem on another entry, which we also outlined in our submission, and that is when once returning to the U.S. from Canada, he failed to present his U.S. passport and instead used the Canadian passport, and he should have presented his U.S. passport. So we also outlined that in the submission. And the only way that we knew that this ever did get resolved is the client no longer called me complaining about being pulled into secondary when coming into the U.S. But, you know, that's an example of a more extreme incident, which obviously probably merited being in the system as a watch. But hopefully now that all full details have been provided and cleared in the system, that this individual won't have the recurring problem.
Great. We have about 2 minutes left. So, Linda, any last-minute thoughts from you for our listeners in terms of solving these agency mistakes?
Just one, and it goes back to what Steve was saying before. You know, we've outlined various things that we can do, but I think the personal touch sometimes is really good. For example, somebody who was designated as a CR when he's supposed to be an LPR or vice versa, we were able to help that situation resolve itself by getting an info pass for the client and going in and talking to somebody. So sometimes that personal, you know, back and forth with a human being is the way to go.
Steve, what about you? Any last parting thoughts on this?
Sure. Well, as both of you have served on ALA liaison committees as well as myself, I mean, it's really a great resource. ALA does a tremendous job in their liaison with the agencies. A lot of these issues are hopefully resolved by the communication back and forth between the government agencies and ALA. And, of course, there's just a wealth of information available on ALA InfoNet and through the liaison process that can help guide you through resolving these issues, and hopefully there's been a lot of good references made to those materials today that can assist our practitioners in helping their clients' cases.
Thank you both. I think the point that you have both made is that you need to use your resources and tools, all of them. I'd like to only add one other thing to that, which is, no matter how trying the circumstance, and I think this goes back to what Linda said, be nice and at least try to be patient. The folks that we're dealing with on the other side, for lack of a better term, are also human beings. They have jobs to do, and the more we can do to make it possible for them to help us, the better off we are. Now, we're not suggesting lie down when they really screw up and don't fight for your client. Far be it from that. But start with niceness and patience and that human touch, and you might actually get your problem resolved before you have to go to war. So we want to thank you all for listening today. We hope this has been helpful. And please remember, use your AILA resources. AILA and its volunteer leadership is there to help you. Thank you.